something, actually, the calculation I'm going to describe is a little bit embarrassingly simple, but that's okay. So in some sense, I was thinking that you may walk away thinking that all I've done is I've come up with a complicated formalism to do a simple question. And maybe that's what we did, but I think we learned a lot on the way. And I will argue that we're basically doing the first step of something where we expect to actually be able to do a lot more. So I'm going to be talking about this paper that we just did recently with my students, William Chung and Saba Zuberi, at the end of last year. And the title kind of says it all. What we're going to be interested in is good old perturbative QCD, you know, those horrible 8,520-page papers that you see full of tulip diagrams and things that I never understand what they are. We're going to, broadly speaking, the idea is to try and make sense of a field which I find very confusing using the language of effective field theory, which I think is exactly the right language to do it in. And we'll be talking about jets both because they're interesting and also because it's a nice starting problem to try and get a handle on things. This is the outline of my talk. I'm going to spend a fair bit of time just kind of on the introduction just to explain to you a little bit about why I think this is an interesting problem and what it is that we think we can do in effective field theory. Then I'll talk a lot about something called SCET, soft collinear effective theory, which is an effective field theory which has been around for almost 10 years now. Originally developed actually to do B-quark physics, and right now people are starting to realize that you can do an awful lot of interesting perturbative, it's more generally an effective field theory for perturbative QCD in jets. And so I'll give you a little bit of an idea of how that works. I will try to avoid any technicalities, but just explain to you what you need to know. Then I'll talk about our actual calculation, how you do jets and phase space in this theory and what we've discovered, and then give you some prospects at the end. How do we start? Well, we all know what a jet is, I hope, right? A jet is, well, you're at a collider, you make some quarks, some gluons, the quarks and gluons don't go up, you never see quarks and gluons, what happens? Well, at short distances, you've got this nice quark production process. But then, of course, as long distance go on, things evolve as the quark moves along, it starts spitting off gluons. The gluons do all sorts of horrible complicated things that you can't, some level, calculate. And then finally, at some point, everything hadronizes and turns into pions and cans and protons and anything else you want. Imagine it slams into somebody's detector and an experimentalist sees a track. And that's what a jet is. So that's fine. Right, so why should you care about jets? It looks kind of ugly. It's QCD. It looks kind of like a mess. I'm going to argue that there's a few reasons why I actually care about jets and why I think you should care about jets. The first is, of course, we see them at colliders. They're very important to understand. You want to actually be able to calculate things about these things because, in particular, there's a lot of jets in backgrounds for things that you want to see. So you'd like to understand as much as you can about how to theoretically predict the standard model for jet processes. So they're backgrounds to new physics processes. On a similar vein, on a slightly more subtle question, is the fact that actually, if you can, and there's been some recent work on this as well, is that if you can understand the structure of jets a little bit more, then that actually can tell you something about what was going on in the underlying short distance process, in particular, whether signatures of the hard scattering process. So for example, if there's some standard model origin, something, some light quark being created and turning into a jet, or if there's something heavy there, which is decaying and turning into a jet, there's actually different signatures. The jets look different. So you'd like to be able to calculate that and know that you reliably know how to calculate it. So that's kind of why you should be interested in jets. You know, that's because we're trying to do sort of useful things for the experiment. It's not always what motivates theorists. What actually motivates me about this problem is because I think it's a really interesting problem in quantum field theory. Because, you know, there's everything in QCD in this problem. This problem is sensitive to QCD over a huge range of energy scales, right? You've got some very short distance process happening here. And then you're sensitive to QCD as you kind of go longer and longer. Things are still perturbative. At some point, everything turns non-perturbative and you turn into hadrons. It's kind of all of QCD is buried in this physics here. And so it's actually a very interesting problem. But I'm kind of an effective field theory guy. I've been doing B physics for quite a long time. And that was the whole idea in B physics. That's how we made so much progress over the last decade, is learning how to take these complicated decays apart into different energy scales and make sense out of them. So the idea is, can we do something similar with jets in QCD? Of course, this is hardly new. People have been trying to calculate these things as long as there have been colliders, right? And this multi-scale nature of the problem is endemic to anything that happens in QCD. Everything you do in QCD is a is a multi-scale process, right? If you want to go do proton-proton goes to TT bar at a collider, you know, here's one of the Feynman diagrams you would have to calculate, you know, and then you calculate this one, and I can give you a gazillion more Feynman diagrams that you would have to calculate. Obviously, we can't do this. So you could say, how is it that we actually make any progress in QCD at all? It's a non-perturbative theory. And of course, you know the reason why we can make progress is because why is that doing that? It should have been a yes. Oh, yeah, there we go. That's what I did. Is because all collider QCD problems are inherently multi-scale problems. And there's a traditional approach in perturbative QCD in these very long papers, which are very hard to understand. What they're really doing is they're setting up something called factorization and factorization theorems. And here's the simplest one that we all know, right? If you want to calculate the cross-section for two protons to make TT bar plus something else, you don't calculate this Feynman diagram. What you do is you break it up into two parts, right? There's one part, which is a short distance part, which is just this short distance amplitude, which is the sigma here. And then you know what you do? You then just convolute this thing with parton distribution functions. And that's this whole mess out here. So this thing just breaks up into these two pieces. You measure these in experiment, and you go ahead and you calculate this for the process you want to know. And we all see this thing, and we've all seen this since we were young, we understand it. This is the simplest example of a factorization theorem, right? It tells you that some horrible, complicated, multi-scale thing pulls out very nicely into two well-defined things, a long-distance part and a short-distance part. So this is perturbative, this is just what I said, this is perturbatively calculable. This is something that you can't calculate, but what makes it useful is the fact that this long-distance stuff doesn't care what's going on at short distances. So it's process independent. So I can go measure these parton distribution functions in some other scattering process. And they don't care, and then I can just plug them into this short distance scattering process. That's what factorization is all about. Right? These things are in particular, the long distance stuff is universal, and the short distance stuff you can go ahead and calculate in perturbation theory. And the fact that it factorizes is actually a non-trivial statement, because it says that these short and long distance contributions are separately well defined. They're infrared and collinear safe. And that's not always the case. So how do you prove this? Yeah. Collinear safe means that it's like infrared safe. It means if you've got some, you often get collinear singularities and things where you've got very hard massless particle and it can split into two almost parallel particles. That can give you an infrared divergence in a calculation. And if you're not careful about what you're defining, often those things can actually introduce divergence into your quantities. So how do you prove that this thing is actually factorizes? Well, then you go back to these papers I was alluding to, and the resolution isn't good enough for you to see all of the stuff which is on here, but this is just supposed to be scary, right? Yeah, it wouldn't help, but it would make it even scarier, right? You know, page 8, page 13, page 24, page 37, it keeps going on. Right? This is one of the classic papers by Colin Soper-Sturman. There are a lot of theorems derived, particularly in the 1980s, understanding factorization of these processes. And it's very difficult because they're very exhaustive analyses of Feynman diagrams and looking exactly where the divergence occurs and looking at the routing of momenta. And to be honest, I don't really understand these papers, but I believe their results. But the physics behind it is very simple, right? It's exactly what we said before. The top quark production, for example, is a short distance process. It's just separation of scales. This is a short distance process, whereas non-complicated hadronic physics is long distance. And so the reason that the PDFs are universal, for example, is simply the fact that it's long distance physics and it can't resolve the details of the short distance physics, which is why hadronization is, at least to a very good approximation, independent of the details of the scattering. Right? There's two scales in this problem and they're widely separated. There's, say, 1/MT where you're making the top quarks, and there's 1/λQCD long distance where they're hadronizing, and there's three orders of magnitude between them. So they factorize nicely. Yes?
How can they prove that the long-distance theory was universal? That's, among other things, you'd have to show confinement.
No, you don't have to do anything with confinement. What you just have to show, I think, is that these things are, you can show that all the long-distance stuff, basically you can just do sort of a Taylor expansion of the short-distance stuff. You can treat it as being point-like. And then when it's point-like, you don't care what the structure is. Maybe that's sort of the intuitive way to say it. And that the thing that would kill you is if when you calculate this long distance process, you discover that it was divergent until you added the short distance process in and that only the sum of them was well defined, which is what typically happens when you try and take a process apart into different Feynman diagrams. You find that only the sum of them is finite.
Can they actually understand the long distance physics in these?
It's long distance, but it's not. You're not looking at non-perturbative physics. You're looking at it's all perturbation theory based. Yeah, that's a good point. It's all staring exhaustively at Feynman diagrams and then arguing that things hold to all orders. But you're right. It is all perturbative. So that's fine. So that's an example of a factorization theorem. I just want to make a point here because it'll be relevant near the end, is that if you start doing something any more complicated than just doing, say, PP bar goes to your final state plus anything, suddenly these factorization theorems become inadequate. So for example, if you want to do like Drellian, PP bar goes to L plus L minus plus stuff, as long as if you then start, say, looking at funny regions of phase space, like where the leptons carry away almost all the energy, so you've got a huge restriction, there's only very soft, only soft hadrons are allowed, the simple parton model picture actually breaks down. And what they showed in these things is that you need a more complicated version of it, where you've got this short distance piece, these parton distribution functions, but you've got to convolute it with something else called a soft function. I'm not going to talk about what it is. I'm just making the point that as soon as you start doing more complicated things to your final state, factorization gets more complicated. And the reason it does is because you introduce new energy scales into the problem. In particular, there's an energy scale Q times 1 minus tau. I'm not even going to define these. Which is essentially the scale of the hadronic physics in this event. It's a new scale in the problem. There's physics at that scale. Now you've got a three-scale problem, and you've got a factorization theorem that splits it up into things which depend on those three different scales. So it gets nastier. So now we get back to jets, the problem that I'm interested in. Another example, here you're restricting the final states. Let's do E plus E minus. That's easier than PP bar. I'm going to do mostly E plus E minus in this talk. Let's do E plus E minus goes to jets. So it's this process right here. So here's my, so let's just think about the scales in the problem. Right, here's my quark, moves along, it's got some energy Q, and as it goes, it starts spitting off gluons as it goes. And you can just kind of stare at this and see that there are at least three scales in the problem. First of all, there's the energy of the jet. So that's something that scales like Q. That's the energy, the center of mass energy of the process. But now this jet is something which has got large energy, but it's going to be narrow. And so it's got a small invariant mass. So I'm just going to define use its invariant mass to define a parameter lambda. So lambda is just defined as the ratio of the invariant mass over the energy. And so that'll be another scale, lambda squared Q squared. And then if I work in light cone coordinates, that means I can write the momentum of the jet as a big piece going in the plus direction, a small piece going in the minus direction, and then a perpendicular piece. And just in order to get p squared equals zero, you can easily see that they have to scale in this way. So you see that actually this is a three-scale problem. Q, lambda Q, and lambda squared Q. And I'm not even talking about hadronization yet. That'll be somewhere down here in general. Lambda is simply defined by this. Lambda is the rate. Something blasting off with small invariant mass and large energy. And so lambda is just the ratio of the invariant mass to the energy. And this is going to end up being my expansion parameter in much of what I do. So it's just defined by this process right here. And as soon as you do that, you immediately see you've got a three-scale problem, which is most obvious in light cone coordinates. Oh, yes. Right. So a multi-scale problem. So the moral of this first part is simply that perturbative QCD processes at colliders tend to have a lot of scales in them. And what makes life complicated is trying to pull apart the physics at all those different scales and figure out how to treat it. Some of the physics is perturbative, some of it's non-perturbative, and so on and so forth. And it turns out that there is a beautiful technique, which is its whole purpose in life, is to deal with this kind of problem. And the word, it's called effective field theory. And this is just a show, and it's such a big thing, it even gets its own Wikipedia page, which you can read about in effective field theory. I want to say that effective field theory has become a bit of a cliche almost, I think, in particle physics, because now everybody's used to talking about everything being an effective field theory, right? The standard model is an effective field theory. This is an effective field theory in Landau-Ginzburg theory is an effective field theory, so forth and so on, all sorts of effective field theories. I want to make the point that when I'm talking about an effective field theory, I'm meaning it more in less than this conceptual way, and more in a very practical way as a tool. And it's a tool which is allowing you to separate scales in a multi-scale process, which is why we're using it. As we'll see, it's essentially a turn-the-crank approach to factorization. And the idea is that once you've got this, in effective field theory, very naturally it falls out. The different momentum regions can all be treated completely separately. So some of them are perturbative, you can calculate, some you extract from experiment, maybe some pieces you pick up from the lattice. All the different relevant momentum scales, the idea is that it separates it, and it separates it automatically without having to, at least hopefully, write 120-page papers staring hard at Feynman diagrams. It should be somehow a bit more automatic. And in particular, it allows you to use the renormalization group in a very efficient way to make perturbation theory work very well, to sum logs of small parameters that you get in a problem. So what it buys you is essentially, it's this turn the crank approach. And I was like just showing this diagram just to, it's a very simple thing. But of course, we use effective field theory all the time, at least in classical physics, right? It's this, and there's nothing more to it than this. So for example, if you're doing classical physics, you've got a bunch of charges, say, and you want to understand, and if the charges, the scale of the physics that you're looking at is L, is of order the distribution of the charges, then life is complicated. Physics is complicated. It all depends on the details of the charge contribution. If I want to know what a particle is doing around here, I got to know everything about these charges. But on the other hand, if I'm interested in long-distance physics, far away from these charges, life gets an awful lot simpler. I really don't have to know about the details of what's going on in the short distance. In fact, I can just get rid of the short-distance physics altogether and replace it by things like the charge, the dipole moment, the quadrupole moment, et cetera. I can completely forget about the short-distance physics and just represent it by a few numbers. And depending on how accurate I want to go, I just include more and more numbers. That's all effective field theory is. And that's the physics why, essentially, why hadronization doesn't care about the short-distance process. It's exactly the same reason that no matter what physics you've got out here, it's not going to care about the quadrupole moment to the first order. It's only going to care about the total charge. And effective field theory just formalizes this. So you write a multipole expansion, and you see you've got some power series expansion. And what you've done is you've divided your physics into short distance quantities, charge, multipole, dipole moment, and so forth, and long distance quantities. And so this is factorization. Factorization in classical electrodynamics. It's exactly the same thing. And you can work to any accuracy you want just by adding more and more moments. Effective field theory is simply the exact same statement in quantum field theory. The idea is that, again, if you're working at low momenta below some scale lambda, you should only include the degrees of freedom relevant to lambda and get rid of everything else. You've integrated them out. And so you get some effective Lagrangian, which is some leading order piece. And then you can take account the corrections in some power series in 1/distance scale times some bunch of operators. And so, again, you split the problem up into short distance quantities. And in QCD, as long as your scale is much greater than lambda QCD, you can calculate these things perturbatively, and a bunch of long-distance quantities, which typically are non-perturbative in QCD, like parton distribution functions. So that's kind of my spiel on how effective field theory works. But the point is it automatically factorizes your calculations, and you can work to arbitrary accuracy. So a few examples just of how this works, because I like to sort of characterize them in this way. There's what, well, it starts off with what I call classic effective field theory, which everybody kind of probably has seen at some point, right? For Fermi theory. If I'm doing scattering of particles with some heavy particle X, I know if the momenta are much less than X, I can always replace this by a for Fermi operator. And then I can renormalize it and so forth, and I know how to work with that. It's a non-renormalizable theory, but that's okay, that doesn't bother me. Similarly, something like this, B-gamma, I can replace by some other operator, integrate at the X. That's the kind of theory that people work with. Then we have what I like to call modern effective field theory, which my example is something called heavy quark effective theory, which I'm not going to talk much about. It's conceptually not much different from what I would call classic effective theory. The only thing that's a little bit funny about it is that here you've got some particle like a B quark, and you're lowering the cutoff of the theory below the mass of the B quark. But you've still got a B quark in your initial state, so you can't get rid of it. It turns out that the effective theory there is a theory in which the bottom quark is replaced by a Wilson line, just a static source of color charge. And so it's an effective field theory of heavy colored stable objects. And this actually pretty much revolutionized the study of B physics close to a couple of decades ago, yeah, when it was first introduced. Ends up being very powerful. It's a simple picture, but very powerful. And then we have what I call postmodern effective field theory, which basically means I still don't fully understand them, and I'm not sure anybody quite fully understands exactly how they work. I'll show it's a little bit more complicated. And the example is the one that I'm going to talk about, which I call soft collinear effective field theory. And it's very much like HQET. Heavy quark theory says it's a theory of a very heavy thing, a heavy colored object. Soft collinear effective theory is the theory of a very light but very energetic colored object. And that's what's in a jet, right? That's a quark in a jet. It's a very light but very energetic object. And it turns out this theory is an awful lot more complicated than this theory. And there's a very simple reason for that. The reason is a heavy quark just sits there, right? You can bounce stuff off, bounce like gluons off, it just sits there, but it's never going to turn into two heavy quarks with half the mass, right? There's no large momentum transfers. The trouble is, you have a light particle moving along with a huge energy, it can split into two light partons, one carrying x and one carrying 1 minus x of the energy. So there's always large momentum transfers in this problem. It turns out this is going to complicate life dramatically. And this is what the examples of what I call postmodern effective field theory do this. They've got these large momentum transfers, and it's a little bit confusing or complicates the theory. Same thing as I've been saying again, Scott. So the idea is, and sort of the theme behind all of what I'm talking about is that this is an approach which is just asking to be applied to traditional perturbative QCD problems. In particular, it's systematically improvable. As I said, the perturbative QCD factorization theorems are all based on, or they're all perturbative, they're all based on staring hard at Feynman diagrams to all orders. Effective field theory, just like including more multiple moments, you can go to arbitrary accuracy, you can go beyond leading order if you need to. It simplifies, in many cases, many of these proofs of factorization. It's much easier in the effective field theory framework to understand the factorization. It's conceptually simpler to look at. There's a whole bunch of sort of disparate things that you need in perturbative QCD to get things to work. Power counting, gauge invariance, or normalization group evolution, they're all there under one framework in effective field theory, which is nice. And the last one, again, which is important, is that in principle, this is a turn-the-crank approach. You just go, and the theory tells you how it works. So the long-term goal behind the stuff I'm talking about is that we really want to understand perturbative QCD factorization, in particular in jet production, using the soft collinear effective theory. So that's what I want to do. So we decide, well, what do we do? Well, let's do a warm-up problem. Let's do the simplest problem we can think of to get started. Let's look at E plus E minus goes to two jets. That is a very simple problem. We're going to do it at order alpha s, right? One gluon. Even I can do that, right? I can calculate that. So can we use this? But I want to do it in effective field theory because I want to use it to use renormalization group evolution to some large logs. So how do I mean? Well, first of all, before I go any further, remind you, there's no actual unique definition of a jet. There's no God-given definition that says this is a jet and this is not, right? All you have is particles in your detector. So you've got to come up with some way of deciding how you're going to clump these particles into a jet. And there's lots and lots of choices on the market, and it changes as a function of time. Here's the oldest definition of a jet. It's called a Sturman-Weinberg jet. And it's an example of something which we now call a cone algorithm. And it's kind of obvious why it's a cone algorithm, because you define some cone with angle delta. And roughly speaking, you say, this particle's in that jet as long as it's within the cone delta. Simple. Trouble is, if you just did that, it wouldn't be infrared safe, because you could always brem off some very soft gluon, which would go off in some other direction outside of the cone. And typically, if you do something with an arbitrarily soft gluon and it changes your result, that means it's not infrared safe. So if you brem off a soft gluon, goes out of the cone, it'll be out of the jet. So that turns out is not infrared safe. But if you add an extra constraint, which is that you say that the energy, you put some cut on the total energy you're going to allow to get outside of the cone, which we'll call beta, then that's an infrared safe definition of a jet. So that's what a Sturman-Weinberg jet is. It says basically all the hard collinear stuff has to be in a cone, but you can have some amount of radiation leak out of the cone without changing it from being a two-jet event. And then you can go ahead and calculate in perturbation theory, what is the cross-section, go E plus E minus goes to two jets. Then you can calculate it, and this is what you get. The only thing to look at is the fact that there are logs. This is hallmark of calculations in perturbation theory. We've got disparate scales. You get logs of the ratios of these scales. And here they are. Log of beta. Beta is the ratio of energy outside cone over Q. And delta, which is the angle, which is also the ratio of the typical perpendicular momentum in the cone to the typical longitudinal momentum in the cone. And so these ratios of scales show up as large logs. And this is actually kind of bad phenomenologically, because you might want to calculate this thing very accurately. And you want to do it for jets which are well collimated. So these parameters are small, which means their logs are big, which means it can spoil perturbation theory. And so what you'd like to do is we would like to be able to resum these logs in a standard renormalization group evolution. So that was the problem we set ourselves. We've got to be able to do that. Right? Can't be that hard. There are other algorithms, and so We figured, well, let's do some other algorithms while we're at it to try and understand that. There's another class of algorithm called cluster algorithms that people use. And they're a little bit, they're different from cone algorithms. The idea in cluster algorithms is you take all the particles in the jet and then you compare some quantity. And if it was, and if that quantity, for example, the invariant mass of these two partons, and if that quantity is below some threshold, what you do is you say, okay, I'm going to merge those into a pseudo particle. So you're going to get rid of those and merge them into this guy. And then you're going to repeat it again. And you're going to keep doing this and doing this and doing this till none of the pseudo particles passes the test. And then you're going to call them all jets. So for example, the first of these written down was called the Jada.
Every process would have jets.
Anything that produces hadrons. Yeah, exactly. So, but the question is, how many jets does it have? You want to know, do I call this, this splattering of hadrons, is this a 2-jet event, a 3-jet event, a 5-jet event? And so this is, this gives you an algorithm to figure out what, how many jets you have. So for example, the Jade algorithm, what you do is you compare the invariant mass of all pairs. And what you do is you look at the pair of particles that have the smallest invariant mass. And if they're less than some cut, some threshold with some small parameter J, you combine them into a pseudoparticle. And you repeat until all the invariant mass of all the pairs is greater than that, and then you stop. There's another one which looks more complicated, but as I'll show you, people actually like better. It's called the KT algorithm, which is the same as J, but they introduced this other variable. It's the invariant mass times the minimum of the ratio of energies. This kind of looks like it was just kind of written, kind of kludged down, like, why would you write this down? I'll show you why you would write this down. But it's because it makes things exponentiate better. But anyway, it's just another algorithm. You know, you can come up with your favorite variable, and you too can have your own jet definition, right? You can include it there. Just for the technically, these are things that are called exclusive jet definitions, which you use for E plus E minus machines. For hadron colliders, you have to modify these a little bit to allow for the fact that you're going to have some small things that you, jets and things going down the beam pipe that you don't want to include, and those are called inclusive jet definitions. Point being, you calculate these things and you get exactly the same problem. You get things that go like alpha log squared j, alpha squared log to the fourth j. So if this parameter is small, you can't calculate these in perturbation theory. You want to resum it. So that was our problem that we wanted to do. What's the current status of the, or what was the status without effective field theory? Sturm and Weinberg, there are some formal results that claim to be resumming leading logs of this. It's unclear from the paper, at least to me, whether or not, I don't know if it's clear to you, Mike. I've never seen a paper before where there's a whole formula there, and I cannot make sense. You know, everything is defined, but you cannot extract an expression from that formula. So I'm not.
I understand every single word.
And I can look at the formula, and I cannot, I cannot make sense of the formula. So I would say it is unclear whether or not one can one has been able to sum those leading logs. Or it's very, well, I'm sure it's very deep. It's George Sturm, and everything he writes is very deep. But I am not strong enough to understand it. Jade is interesting because it turns out that the claim is that you can't resum logs in Jade. They do not form any nice pattern that you can resum. They do not exponentiate. And I'm going to actually show you why, just because it's sort of amusing why that is, which is why people don't like the Jade algorithm. The problem is, if you go to order alpha squared, so now I'm going to emit two gluons. Now let's look at the region of phase space where both of these gluons are pretty soft. So their energies are small, but they're going roughly speaking collinear. One is going roughly collinear with say, the anti-quark, and the other is going roughly collinear with the quark. Any sensible jet algorithm would call that a 2-jet event, right? The problem is Jade doesn't. Because what does Jade do? Well, Jade says, look at the pair of particles which have the smallest invariant mass. So first of all, let's imagine that 1 and n, the invariant mass of them is less than the threshold. So if there weren't gluon 2, this would be a 2-jet event. And that the invariant mass of these two is small. So if there weren't gluon 1, this would be a 2-jet event. The trouble is, if these guys are sufficiently soft, then their invariant mass is going to be even smaller. So Jade says combine them first, and you get a jet going straight up, which is not what you would want to do. But it's what it tells you to do. And so it gives you a 3-jet event. And the problem is, this actually contributes at leading log. It gives you a contribution to order alpha squared log to the fourth j. And so that's something that you should get from the one looper normalization group equations, which means it's something you should get from the one gluon expression. But without doing any derivation, it's kind of obvious that you'll never see this effect with one gluon, because if you only had one gluon, this would never happen. It's sort of a peculiarity of Jade at two loops, but what at or at least at order alpha squared. But what this means is that So people just went, people used to just look at JADE and they wrote that said, well, the answer must be e to the one loop, basically, because everything, because things exponentiate in QCD. And then they calculated and discovered it wasn't for this reason. And that's why KT was invented. KT was invented solely with that extra factor, which stopped you from doing that, stopped you combining those in there. That's the reason for that extra piece in KT, is that, and what you can show is, in fact, the leading logs do exponentiate. That is, it's roughly e to the, the total answer at leading log is basically e to the one loop, which is what a simple one loop renormalization group equation would also tell you. However, I think it's not clear how to go beyond this, how to sub some leading logs, or even if they form any discernible pattern. And finally, there isn't actually any factorization theorem for jets and perturbative QCD, but we're still going to attack the problem in effective field theory. So, as I say, our calculation's simple, so hopefully that'll be quick. So I'm going to tell, now I'm going to tell you the quick lightning essentials of soft collinear effective theory, which is the tool we need to do this. So the question is, what's the correct effective field theory to describe the dynamics of a very light energetic quark? So something where the minus component of the momentum is much, much less than the plus component. So this is going very close to the light cone with some small perpendicular component. This is actually something that we've been working on since around 2000. It's been applied, it was originally developed to describe B decays in sort of things like B-S gamma and jetty regions of phase space, but it was soon realized that it's a theory of jets. We should be applying this to perturbative QCD. So let's look at the physics of this. So what can this thing do? So I've got my quark blasting along here. What can it do and still conserve momentum and have everything stay on the mass shell? Well, it could emit what I'll call a soft gluon. So this thing can be blasting along and just spitting off gluons that are so soft that they don't deflect its world line. Much like a heavy quark sitting there interacting with soft glue, it doesn't affect the heavy quark's world line. The same thing for this light thing. It can just be blasting along, emitting soft radiation. And it turns out you can show by power counting that if the momentum of the soft radiation goes like lambda, the small component, lambda squared q, it won't deflect the world line of this thing. So you can do that until the cows come home and you're still moving along the same world line in leading order in lambda. And that, if that were the story, then this thing would just be like heavy quark effective theory, except with a light like Wilson line. The trouble is, as I said, it can do something else. It could split. It can't split into arbitrary momentum things, but it can split into two collinear, almost collinear partons. So one carrying, say, x of the momentum, and one carrying 1 minus x. And so now we've had a large momentum transfer. And so notice that the momentum of this guy, of this gluon, scales differently with lambda than this gluon. Here it's looked like it's on the light cone. Here all the components are of the same size. It can be going in any direction. So those are the two things it can do, and then the whole thing can evolve, and it eventually turns into a jet with the same power counting that I talked about before. So what that tells you is that this effective field theory has to have because the scaling's different, we've got to have different kinds of degrees of freedom to describe them. We have to have what we're going to call soft particles, and soft particles are particles who, in light cone coordinates, the momenta all scale the same way as lambda, the small parameter lambda squared times the big scale. So here's our scale down here. Soft particles have energy of order that. Collinear particles are going to be mostly going along the light cone with a lot of energy. So it's going to scale like q in one direction, lambda squared q, and lambda q. Both of these can be on the mass shell. They can interact. And this is actually what makes this theory, when I talk about postmodern effective field theories, these are these ones where you start out a particle like a gluon in the original theory has got to be described by different modes in the effective theory. One of the things which I think has not been shown in these theories, or I find very confusing, and people argue about it, is how do you know you got all the modes, right? You sort of have to look at Feynman diagrams and see where singularities come in, but how do you know you don't have to, at 8 loops, worry about lambda to the fourth, lambda to the fourth, lambda to the fourth particles. So for me, this is just a technical aside, but people do argue a little bit about whether this is all you need in the theory. But clearly, you certainly do need collinear particles and soft particles, both for gluons and then for quarks.
Does that mean
the
power counting only works with only known orders?
Sorry, the what has?
So if you were to power count this and you want to know the
Almost everything done in SCT is at leading order. There's been a very little bit of order lambda stuff, but almost all of it, particularly if you want to apply it to hadron colliders, lambda tends to be very tiny, so you're not worried about power correction. But yeah, the theory gets really quite ugly beyond leading order and lambda, so there's been very little stuff done at that order. And I think there's certainly been some subleading stuff done, and everything's worked so far. But people argue about things called Glauber modes and such, which have different scaling, which they argue whether they actually occur or not. So I think the jury's a little bit open on. But what do you get out of this theory? The point is, you want to go to an effective theory because it buys you something. It simplifies life somehow. Well, it turns out there's a beautiful thing that happens in SCT, which is that these soft and these collinear modes factorize. And they factorize at the level of the Lagrangian. It's very nice when things factorize at the level of Lagrangian. Then you don't need to prove a lot of things because it's just it's obvious. Right? It's like having a symmetry in your Lagrangian. You know that something is true by symmetry. You end up knowing a lot of things are true in SCT by factorization. So in particular, in SCT, you can have some jet of collinear, say these are all collinear gluons, and then you can have some soft gluon attached to it. What you can show rigorously, actually just by a simple field redefinition, is that this soft gluon couples to this entire mess as if it were just a single light like Wilson light. Which makes sense physically, right? It says that a soft gluon with big wavelength, if you've got some huge jet of particles blasting, all it sees is color charge moving at the speed of light. It can't resolve anything anymore. And this drops out of the Lagrangian, is that soft gluons can't resolve what's going on in a collinear jet. And so suddenly your couplings are much, much simpler. This is hard to calculate. This is really easy. Similarly, if I've got stuff going, say I've got a two-jet event. I've got one jet going this way and one jet going this direction. It's the same thing. All the collinear particles in this jet can't resolve what's going in that other jet. Which is so all they see is something in their reference frame. All they see is something going backwards at the speed of light. And so all they see is a light like Wilson line going backwards at the speed of light. So similarly, if I've got two jets, and they don't have to be back-to-back, as far as the guys in this jet are concerned, all they see from this thing is something going recoiling from them at the speed of light, and all they see is its color charge. And so again, the coupling between different collinear directions is trivial. And you lose, and so again, you end up getting factorization at a very simple level. The factorization here meaning that it's not sensitive to anything except the fact there is something moving at the speed of light. It doesn't know what's going on. And it turns out that is what makes it easy to prove factorization theorems in SCT, is the fact that all these things just decouple. And you tend to get factorization theorems of this form, that you show that some process typically is of the form of some thing they call H, which is a hard function. This is the physics which is above the scale Q. So it's in QCD, it's all the virtual stuff above Q, which the effective theory gets wrong. It's a matching condition. It just, that goes into what they call the hard function. Then there's something called the jet function, and that's all the physics of the collinear stuff, which lives at lambda Q. And this thing tends to be convoluted in some way with physics at the soft scale, at the square lambda squared Q, which is called the soft function. And so one tends to get these rather complicated factorization theorems. But that's kind of how they come out of SCT, is that you've got degrees of freedom that are jetty, you've got soft degrees of freedom, and then you've got some coefficients in front of your operators of the theory from matching QCD onto it.
Do you have a strong opinion on the convolution integrals and the endpoints of convolution?
A strong?
With respect to whether factorization is really, once it's proven in the Lagrangian, through that step of the convolution integrals.
You're thinking of SCT, you're thinking of like when you're going to hadrons. I think that all works kind of a technical thing. I think that all works out with the zero bin. We may have to. I don't have a strong opinion. I don't have a strong take on that. Here I'm actually just looking at totally inclusive things where we are splitting things up into these different scales. But, I think the zero bin arguments actually got rid of a lot of that, but oh.
People still disagree.
Maybe, I'm sure, yeah. Maybe we can, you might want to talk about it offline because it's going to. Yeah. Quarks and exactly. All the collinear degrees of freedom decouple from the soft degrees of freedom, and the collinear degrees of freedom in different directions. Or they don't quite decouple, but they couple to them in a very trivial way as a Wilson line. And that's basically it's the coupling of the Wilson line which gives you the convolution. The fact they still talk to each other, but in a very simple way, is why you get a convolution. So that's what's nice about it, is that the hard, as I said, the hard stuff is at the scale Q. Oops. The jet stuff is at the scale lambda Q. The soft stuff is at the scale lambda squared Q. Pulls them all apart. That's what you want to do in order to understand things. The point is, again, each one of these depends on physics at a single scale. And so what you can do is now that you've split it up into three bits you understand, now you just use your renormalization group evolution. You can just evolve each one of these things to its appropriate scale. You get rid of any large logs in perturbation theory, and it should sum all the ratios of large logs, which is what we want to do in this problem. I'm going to give I have to give this one technical aside because it's actually important to what we do. Something called zero bin subtraction. And what's the problem? Well, the problem is we've done this slightly weird thing, right, where we've said a collinear gluon is now a completely different field from a soft gluon. Like, they're as unlike one another as a top quark is from an up quark, right? They're just totally different than the effect of Lagrange, and they have absolutely nothing to do with one another. But then you worry a little bit about double counting. Because if I've got some hard collinear gluon and I start taking its momentum to zero, isn't that the same physics that's in the soft gluon? So what have I done? Am I double counting? So this is one of these subtleties that arises in these theories that sometimes makes it look like you're going back and making up the rules as you go along. But the answer is, yes, that is a problem. These are the same things. You got to watch out for double counting. And in fact, it was shown in a nice paper a couple of years ago by Manohar and Stewart that, in fact, you had to do this to get the right answer. So in particular, if you've got some loop diagram like this, which you, with a collinear particle that you just naively do as d4q times I, and that actually gave you the wrong answer. Because it's also including the region where this thing is getting very soft, but that's already been included in the soft graph, which is another graph in your theory. So in fact, you have to subtract that away. The reason nobody had noticed this before is typically for the examples one had looked at, these graphs were always, these were always scaleless integrals. And in dimensional regularization, all scaleless integrals go away. And so it wasn't obvious. All they really do is they convert an infrared divergence into an ultraviolet divergence. But they showed that, in fact, in order to get the divergences of the integral to be ultraviolet, you had to include this. And as I'll show you, they're less trivial in the example we did. But this is called the zero bin. This is the p goes to zero. You've got to subtract off the limit as this goes to soft. So there's an extra piece of a graph you have to do. And that's going to come up in the calculation. So. Okay, so my long-winded warm-up. That was what we wanted to do. That was the tool we were going to do it. As I say, it's a pretty trivial calculation, but I'll show you there's a little bit of a subtlety here. So let's go back to our initial problem. E plus E minus goes to jets. So we wanted to calculate this in SCET, and then hopefully all these logs of delta and beta or J or whatever would all turn out to be nice logs of ratios of scales. We'd sum them with a normalization group. We'd say, hurrah. You know, maybe we'd understand why some things didn't exponentiate and some things did. So we thought, okay, let's look at three different jet definitions, Sturman-Weinberg, Jade, and KT. Let's calculate the two jet rated order alpha S and do a renormalization group improvement of all of this. So it turns out the one slightly tricky thing, and the one sort of, if you want to say, the one conceptual thing that we actually had to think fairly hard about and was wrong in the literature was how you actually do a bloody phase space integral in SCET. Theory had been around for almost 10 years. Nobody actually, as far as I can tell, done a phase space integral that was non-trivial. The reason being that everyone was looking at very inclusive processes. And so what does the phase space look like? So I just want to walk you through the phase space of the problem because it's actually been instructive. So you can't quite read this. P3 is the momentum of the gluon. So I'm going to work in the my coordinates are going to be the plus and minus components of the gluon momentum. So first of all, roughly speaking, if P3 plus or P3 in the shaded region of this, it's easy to convince yourself, is in any sensible jet definition, is going to be a two jet event. But when you're sitting here in the middle, you're going to be at a three jet event. And the actual shape of this thing depends on whether or not, depends on your jet definition. But roughly speaking, your phase space is going to look like that. And you're going to want to integrate over this gray area. So how do you do it? Well, it looks like it's a little bit weird in SCET, because it looks like your degrees of freedom change. That's what makes the phase space integrals a little bit weird in SCET. Because it looks like as you move along here, you go, start going from soft gluons to collinear gluons to soft quarks. So you want to do a phase space integral, but your degrees of freedom keep changing as you go along. So what do you do? So for example, region A, P3 plus and P3 minus are small. That's a soft gluon. I know how to describe that in SCET. Two collinear quarks and a soft gluon. But now let's work our way up to B. What's going on in B? Well, going up in B, now I'm increasing the plus component. Now this thing's got a P3 plus component, which is scaling like Q. So it's a collinear gluon. So I've got a collinear quark or collinear gluon. And anti-quark, and then a quark going the other way. So I've got new degrees of freedom. Up in C, the quark has become soft. Now it's a quark and a jet recoiling and a soft anti-quark. And similarly, you can fill up all the regions of phase space, and it's easy to convince yourself that each of these different regions has a completely different description in terms of degrees of freedom in SCET. So the question is, well, how am I going to do a phase space integral over all of this? And the first thing you might think is kind of the obvious one, well, let's just draw lines. Right? Let's divide up our phase space you know, something like this, draw lines wherever. So everything in here we're going to describe with one set of degrees of freedom, everything in here with another group, and everything in here with another group, and then we'll kind of integrate up into those lines. Well, that seems kind of arbitrary, because, you know, who tells you where to draw these lines? The theory doesn't have any hard cutoffs in it. That's clearly not the right thing to do. You're going to introduce all sorts of corrections, threshold corrections at every one of these lines. That can't be right. The answer, which had been in the literature, was simply to integrate all modes over all phase space, because all the modes are there in the theory, so they should be all integrated over everything. The trouble with that is that doesn't work, because as soon as you do that, here you've got a soft gluon being integrated all the way up to Q. That's infinitely far above the cutoff of the theory. You can't integrate a soft, you're not supposed to be integrating particles up above their cutoffs. That doesn't make sense. So what's the answer? Well, it turns out the answer turns out to be quite straightforward. It just took us a while to figure it out. That the answer is, well, you do that, but you've got to be consistent with your power counting. And what does that mean? Well, that means, here I'm just this is just my scaling variables again. Is that you've got to be, is that since the momentum of different modes scale differently with lambda, you've got to make sure that when you put in your phase space constraints, you're consistent with that scaling. So for example, if I want to do jade and I want to look at the invariant mass of a collinear quark and a soft gluon, it's p1 plus p3 squared. But all the components of these things scale differently. And if I'm consistent, I've got to take the leading order in lambda piece and throw everything else away. If I do that, I get a very different constraint. It just becomes a constraint on p1 minus and k3 plus. And so my old constraint in QCD, which was the whole region of phase space, becomes something much different in SCT. So what you end up getting is that your phase space region in full QCD that you would integrate over changes. It means you've got to integrate over everything over all phase space, but you have different phase space for soft and collinear degrees of freedom. So for example, in jade in the collinear, you end up integrating over an infinite band here. You end up integrating up to infinity here. That just means you're integrating up above the cutoff, up to the cutoff. And then you've got some finite line here. So your collinear phase space looks like this, and your soft phase space looks like this bar here. In KT, something similar happens, except the little trick in there is that it turns out that the zero bin subtraction you have to do has got a different phase space from the collinear and the soft. So there's three different regions of phase space that you have to work out. And that was, it's kind of an obvious point, but that nobody had quite gotten it right before. And it seemed to be confusing more people than us. But anyway, it wasn't obvious. No, thank you. I didn't think it was obvious. But once, in retrospect, it's obvious. And now we're done. Or now we know how to do the calculation. And so this is basically the calculation that you do. There's physics at three different scales. So what do you do? Well, the first thing you do is you do a matching calculation from SCT, at least from QCD, onto some operator, some two-quark operator in SCT. So up at the scale Q, you calculate all the graphs in QCD, and you subtract off the graph. So here would be a QCD graph. And then you subtract off the same one-loop graphs in QCD. The difference between those is local, and it goes into the coefficient operator. That's the hard coefficient. This has been done many times before. Here's the answer. Notice that the logs are all mu over Q. Good. That's what you want. This is all happening at one scale. And this is just the, this absorbs the ultraviolet divergences. This is the counter term. So that's the first part of the calculation, a standard effective field theory matching. Then you want to run down to the jet scale. The jet scale, you've got the collinear guys coming out, and you integrate them over the collinear phase space. So here's where the zero bin comes in, because it turns out you calculate the collinear thing, and if you look at this thing, there's no nice scale. Here's a mu, this one's minimized at mu equals q. This one's minimized at mu equals square root j of q. Here's a log of j without any scale in it, which wouldn't be being summed. So this thing doesn't look very nice. But when you subtract off the zero bin, which in this case is not zero, it's not a zero integral, it's actually a non-trivial integral. When you subtract this from this, all the nasty stuff goes away. And the collinear piece all depends, again, only on one scale. Mu equals root jq. So that's the physics of this scale. This is the collinears. Then you do the softs, and beautifully everything shows that everything is dependent on the soft scale, mu equals jq. Combine them together. You hold your breath. Because what have I got? Remember, this was the answer, this very simple answer. I'm not sure I'd written this down before. This was the one-loop answer for jade that had been calculated in QCD. It just had these j's, these large logs, but they weren't obviously logs of ratios of scales. What we've done is we've pulled this simple expression apart into a bunch of complicated expressions, but each one of them has got its own scale. There's a hard piece, a jet piece, and a soft piece, and you add all these things up, and you get some divergences, and all the divergences are, as they should be, canceled by the counter term, and it all works out beautifully, and you go, phew, everything worked. And you feel very proud of yourself because you've pulled the process apart into the different scales. You factorize the jet rate. So that's kind of, I'll show it for the other ones, but that's basically, that was sort of the nicest result that we had. But I'm going to give you a caveat in a second. So some comments on this. First of all, again, the zero bin subtraction is non-trivial and required. And we had to subtract off these bits where the collinear went to zero. The second piece is, well, let's be a little bit careful here, because when you go back, this is actually something non-trivial. If you go back to these regions of phase space that you're integrating over, notice that the phase space integrals went up to infinity. You don't normally get phase space integrals that go up to infinity. When things go up to infinity, you tend to get divergences. Well, you say, fine, divergences of counter terms. Yeah, but there's no such thing as a tree-level counter term, right? There's no such thing as a counter term that will subtract off a phase space divergence. Right? Counter terms arise at one loop. You don't have a tree-level thing here. So what you're going to get, and you do get ultraviolet, you get ultraviolet divergences in the collinear integrals and ultraviolet divergences in the soft integrals. But what cancels them? It's not obvious from this calculation what cancels them, because dimensional regularization, ultraviolet, collinear, and infrared divergences all show up as 1 over epsilon. So it's not clear what happened, except that when you added everything together, it did get canceled. So we went ahead and we did the whole calculation again with an explicit infrared regulator, a mass for the an off-shellness for the quarks, just so that we knew that all the 1 over epsilons were then pure ultraviolet divergences. And we found something very interesting was happening in the effective field theory, which is that the ultraviolet divergences were canceling, but they were canceling between the soft and the collinear modes. Right? These two things which are supposed to have absolutely nothing to do with one another, right? They're completely different fields in the effective theory. There's no symmetry relating them. There's nothing going on. But it turns out that what's happening is that there's a very delicate cancellation occurring in the ultraviolet divergences of the phase space integrals, so that the ultraviolet divergences are canceling in the real emission. So the total real emission is ultraviolet finite and doesn't need a counter term. This is actually something that had been seen before at the loop level in SCT. It turns out that you can't even renormalize the theory without both soft and collinear, that you end up getting funny infrared divergent ultraviolet divergences unless they're both there. So we're seeing it again. So it's telling us there's some sort of redundancy in the theory. But basically, there's an unphysical region you're integrating over the collinear guys over. You're integrating the soft guys over the same unphysical region, and they're canceling. And we're still kind of seeing if we can make any money out of that observation, but we haven't yet. You're right. Yes, it didn't take care of it. We're actually going to see it more in the next one, more explicitly. But it means that, well, you split them up properly, but there are still ultraviolet. But somehow you need both modes in the theory to make it consistent. You can't just pull one away. You're right. And the last thing is the fact that I was very pleased with how this all worked out, but the soft physics has got to be more subtle than what you get in there, for exactly the same reason I said before, that we've got these, we know that Jade, if you tried to solve the renormalization group and do what I was saying, just run things down, what you would get is you would get a simple exponentiation, and you'd think you'd sum the leading logs, and you'd get the answer wrong, precisely from these configurations I talked about before. I think what this means, these are something that actually, they seem to be in the literature of perturbative QCD. They call them non-global logs. As far as I can tell, what this means is that you do a calculation, you solve the renormalization group, and you discover you get the answer wrong. And the logs that you got wrong, you call non-global logs. You give them a name, and then you say that I can sum the global logs, but not the non-global logs. But this seems to be something that happens typically in perturbative QCD when you have funny regions of phase space that you're integrating over on. And what I'm hoping is that as we pursue this, we will start to understand what this means, that the effective field theory language will give us an understanding of what's going on here. Presumably this has something to do with a failure factorization for jets, but we still need to understand that. Anyway, the same thing kind of goes through. I'll go through this quickly for the other jet definitions. Each one had a little new twist. Sturman Weinberg had just the technical fact that the zero bin phase space was different from the soft phase space. But you work it all out, you add everything up, you get exactly the right answer. Here we had another problem. Here everything didn't look as beautiful. Here we had nice logs of mu over delta for the intermediate scale. Here we had nice logs of mu over beta for the soft scale. But we also had logs that we couldn't sum. I think what that's telling us is that the soft theory is more complicated, is that there's more physics that SCT is not yet unraveled at the low scale, because we can't sum these logs yet. So it's another thing we're worrying about right now. But at least we get the right answer in the theory. But we can't sum these logs yet. We can sum these logs, but not these. They're non-global. KT is another weird, KT did something really weird, which is you try and calculate the KT distribution. Yeah?
In one of the cases, you didn't get these global logs. In one of them, you did?
No, in one of them, we didn't at one loop, but they're there at two loops.
Oh.
And so we got them, we thought, yeah, great, we got the right answer. Then we realized that we'll get the wrong answer at two loops. So they're there. I think all of this is probably telling us that there are more scales in the theory. Particularly if you look at that two-loop calculation, it turns out there's a lower scale, like j squared, j to the fourth q squared or something that enters. So the hope is that somehow if you do it right in the effective theory, it'll unravel the net. We've got to match onto a new theory, which is going to unravel the lower scales. Basically, we think that we've got the theory right down to the collinear scale, but there's some new effective theory with different degrees of freedom that we have to match onto. The KT one was subtle because it turns out you just merrily go ahead and think everything's going the same. And just due to the very precise shape of this curve, because d sigma dk3, it turns out, goes like 1 over k3 minus in d dimensions. There's a 1 over epsilon. It turned out that the phase space integral diverged in all dimensions. Right? Normally, dimensional regularization makes everything finite. This was infinite in all dimensions. So we couldn't even calculate the rate in SCT. So what's going on in that? Well, it turned out what was going on was a very subtle interaction with the zero bin. This is the soft degrees of freedom. If you look at this zero bin that we were subtracting off, you've got a phase-space integral with exactly the same asymptotic behavior. And it turns out this divergence cancels between these two things. But that's a bit weird. Well, what's good about it is it means the divergence cancels. So the sum, remember, this is part of the collinear graph. So it means that the sum of the soft and collinear gives you the right answer, as it did. On the other hand, it looks like it's telling you that factorization cannot work, because it's telling you that the soft and the collinear are separately divergent in all dimensions. And so it looks like the result was telling us that the KT, we don't know if the other things factorize, but it looks like it's telling us that KT does not factorize. So we worried about this for a little bit, but then realized, again, that it wasn't telling us that at all. It didn't seem to be a failure of factorization. It seemed to be a failure of dimensional regularization. Because people had actually done these calculations before, except they'd done them with cutoffs. And so we went back and said, well, let's do the same thing. But now instead of doing it in dim reg, let's just put a cutoff in the plus and minus directions. And you can do the whole calculation with a cutoff, regulating your ultraviolet. And then everything's finite. You don't have to worry about this thing going up to infinity and not being able to integrate it. You just integrate it to a finite amount. And it turns out you can calculate the soft graph, and it's perfectly finite. The collinear graph is perfectly finite. And you add them up, and you get the right answer. Yes, John? These weren't higher divergences. These are, I think what it's telling you is that because you got the answer right, right? Remember what happened in dim reg in all the other things. All this unphysical region up here actually gave us divergences in the other schemes. But the divergences it gave us canceled between the soft and the collinear graphs. Right? So it meant that, but on the other hand, here, you had a similar divergence, but dim reg just didn't regulate it. But it still canceled between the soft and the collinear graphs. So in a sense, the divergence was never there at all. The divergence only went when we tried to use dim reg to define our factorization scheme. Because basically, dimensional regularization is defining what you mean by your jet piece and your soft piece. And what it tells us is that somehow dim reg, and this was something that hadn't been appreciated before, that your ultraviolet regulator changes how it factorizes the graph into soft and collinear. So all we've done here, by introducing a cutoff, all we've done is we've taken this one amplitude and we pulled it apart into a differently defined soft and collinear piece. And then it's finite. So basically what we learned from this is that in SCT, when SCT factorizes something into soft and collinear pieces, that it does that in a regulator-dependent way, which is OK. But it was nice to get a finite answer out of this. So at the moment, we're kind of this is sort of the stage thus far then. So what have we done? Well, we've just demonstrated consistent power pounding for these phase space integrals. We've shown you need all these weird things of SCT like non-trivial zero bins. There's this cancellation of ultraviolet divergence, but it all works. You can calculate all these things, you get the right answer in SCT, does the right power counting. What we're still learning about and trying to understand is how to do these for normalization group evolution, which, you know, at the start we thought, this has got to be easy, this has got to just fall out. And it's non-trivial. There seem to be logs that you can't sum. There's an open question whether this is a real fact that these just have no pattern and cannot be summed, or whether we just don't have the right effective field theory yet, and we just have to think a little bit harder about the soft physics, something we're thinking about right now. Maybe just there is no factorization theorem for these things, and you just can't properly even define the things that you're running. We're not sure. So we're trying to unravel these things. And so I think to go further, we need to understand a little bit more about how these things actually factorize. So if you give me just another 2 minutes, I just want to make a couple of, yeah.
So you said for the soft, you know, that there are more scales.
Yeah.
But in the definition, it's not obvious it's in more scales, unless you're doing some weird combination.
The trouble with jet definitions is it's not clear what the scales are at all, right? Because you have, you've got a whole bunch of particles, and then you've got some dimensionless parameter. And then you've got some iterative instructions on how to do it. It's very hard to look at that. So if I've got a dimensionless parameter and a scale, so if I've got j and q, scales, jq, j squared q, j cubed q, j to the fourth, I can tell you as many scales as you want. And so I think that's probably going to be what's going to be confusing about jet definitions and why they may not even have a simple factorization theorem, because they may be infinite scale processes.
The hypothesis is that that somehow there's more scales hidden in the jet definition that you have to basically pull apart.
Exactly. For example, when you do the two-loop calculate,
that log is a combination of different logs.
That log that's left over could be a ratio of j to the fourth over j squared or something awful. I know that if you stare at the phase space integral for the two gluons, you do see that lower scale shows up as a limit. So it may be that there's just more and more soft scales in the theory. And that may tell you something deep about jets, about our inability to, to define jets beyond a certain accuracy.
One soft function or a soft function that's decomposed further.
Soft function would have to get decomposed into more things, right? As you just run, again, you're running down the scales, summing logs, but there should be some more theories as you keep going down. That would be the idea.
It's surprising. You're surprised too, you just look at the definition, it looks like there's just one scale.
You got a dimensionless number and a scale. That's an infinite number of scales in principle. That's the problem. We're used to thinking
this. That didn't happen at the collinear scale.
Nope. No, but the collinear was the first one.
Yeah.
Maybe you're just going to head each one as you go down.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah. I think that's what that's the thing, again, when I call postmodern effective theory, those are theories where the scales are not all obvious for exactly that reason. You can't, it's not like, in HQET, what's the scale? The mass of the charm core, right? I know what that, there's MC, there's lambda QCD, there's MB, they're real. Here, they're just dimensionless numbers times the scale. And I think that's what makes your life confusing.
But then there's got to be some way to understand why the collinear is so simple compared to the soft.
Well, the collinear is just the first scale. Because that's just the first scale you saw, if you like. And you can keep hitting more scales as you go down.
Why can't I take?
Why can't you take J to the 7/8?
Yes.
I don't know, maybe that shows up at 8 loops. No, you're right. I think that's I think that's this is not as simple. Everything is not as straightforward in this kind of theory, at least to me. So let me just finish off with a couple of things just to talk about some other work which is going on just very quickly. There's been some beautiful work by Lee Sturman and Hornig and Ovanshin and some recent things by Steve Ellis and collaborators, where they, I always like it when traditional perturbative QCD people are now paying attention to this, people like Ellis and Sturman, which gives us some credibility to the whole game. But they're interested in using this whole techniques to go further in looking at jet definitions. In particular, remember I said that you want to look at things like the structure of a jet that can tell you things about what decayed to make the jet, what the short distance physics is. And so one of the ways to characterize a jet are by things called event shapes. And so, for example, you can define these continuous event shapes called tau sub a, where basically you look at all the particles in the jet, you multiply the transverse momentum relative to the jet axis, times some e to the minus rapidity times 1 minus a, reminding you if you're going along the jet axis, it is infinity and a is 0 here. So depending on a, you're just weighting different directions in the jet more or less. So this tells you something about the distribution of energy in the jet. A equals 0 is something called thrust, a equals 1 is called jet broadening. Turns out if you work out this, there are at least these three scales in the problem. There's q, tau to this funny power times q, and tau times q. So again, there's a hard jet, and a soft scale. And what they did is some very nice work where they proved a factorization theorem for this thing, showed that it split up into things which depended on these scales. Went ahead, did the complete renormalization group evolution of these things, and came up with some very nice predictions for how things should work in QCD for all sorts of different jet shapes. And more recently, they've been generalizing this, looking at multi-jet final states, defining distributions for the shapes of the individual jets. They proved a non-trivial factorization theorem for some of these jet-shaped distributions, and they did some nice renormalization group analysis of this. And again, this is a complicated system. And once you have multiple jets with different jet definitions, you've got all sorts of scales in the problem. The jet energies, the angular cuts, the jet shapes, other parameters you introduce by the jet algorithm. It'll be hard to do this in a traditional approach. And finally, the last thing is simply to say, of course, what we really want to do is apply, we've just been doing E plus E minus because we want to have to run or walk before you can run. You want to eventually do this at Hadron Colliders. Of course, life is complicated in Hadron Colliders because you've got a non-trivial incoming state. And as I said at the beginning, the parton model is only strictly applicable without introducing large logs and such for fully inclusive final states. And there's been some nice work by Stuart Tachman and Balajwin in the end of last year, where they showed that, well, first of all, if you're doing something fully inclusive, it's fine, you can use the parton model. If you're looking at something like Drolyanier threshold, where all the energy is going into an L plus L minus, that had been known for years as well by Collins, Soper, Sturm, and there was this more complicated factorization theorem. What they showed is that if you're interested in what you're really probably more interested in the LHC, which would be something where you're not right at the end point, so you've got these things are colliding, you can have big jets going down the beam pipe, but you want to veto on central jets for a big high PT event. What they showed is that they proved in SCT that there was a factorization theorem for that, which looks really quite awful in here. Basically, they introduced something called a beam function, which is related to a parton distribution function, but it's got more scales in it. But they showed that in order to look at events like this, you needed to have this more complicated factorization. So that's the kind of thing that we're going to have to include if we want to actually start looking at jets being produced, say a two-jet event at the LHC with stuff going down the beam pipe. So, gone on for a long time, so let me just give you a few more examples of things that people have been, or just list a few more things people have been doing in SCT recently for collider physics. Manohar and collaborators have done a lot of work on electroweak processes at the LHC, gauge boson production, summing Sudikoff logs in those processes. Becker and Schwartz had a recent paper doing hard photon production in hadron collisions. Mantri and Petriello were looking at Higgs transverse momentum distribution. There's work on Drolyan, work on TT bar production. So it's a very active field right now. There's a whole number of groups trying to go ahead and trying to understand a lot of aspects of hadronic physics in this language. So, thank you. So.
So what happens if you have two protons colliding in the LHC, ATV, center of mass, you've got this mesh of jets coming out, can you apply this?
Not yet. I mean, you could. In principle, that's what you want to do.
That's what we want
to do. Right now, what you do is you Monte Carlo it, basically. You run it in and you put it through Monte Carlos. I mean, then the question will be when we can. The real question is when. I don't think we're at the stage yet where anybody working in SCT has done something demonstrably better than what is being done right in the field. So I think that, I mean, what is shown, for example, Christian Bauer and Matt Schwartz did some nice work where they were showing that. I mean, what effective field is supposed, well, I think the end thing that you want to get out of this effective field theory is there's still going to be stuff, obviously you're going to have to Monte Carlo stuff at the end, you're going to have to run them through hadronization and such. What you want, I think what the effective field theory approach would be is it would, you only want your Monte Carlo and your models to do low energy physics. You don't want it to be trying to do a lot of high energy physics that you could actually do in the effective field theory analytically properly. And I think that's kind of the approach that things are going, that you want to separate your scales properly so that you end up only relying on models to start doing things like to do low energy stuff that you actually can't calculate. But yeah, at the moment we're doing E plus E minus because we're just starting. At some point, yes, you'd want to be able to. It's not known. There isn't actually a factorization theorem yet, even a rigorous one, saying that say PP bar goes to two hard jets plus other stuff in the forward and backward direction factorizes.
Physics, if you want to calculate in plus E minus at the W, if you look at the papers from that, it's a ghastly list of what to call it. It's very hard to know what they're doing. They claim to come out of their rounds.
Well, you're always going to have to Monte Carlo a lot of stuff at the end, right? This is simply a question of can you get those high energy perturbative things? Can you do some of that? How much of that stuff can you do analytically instead of relying on showering and things to, which doesn't get the logs right, sort of beyond leading a log. So it's still going to be something which is going to work together with traditional approaches.
So how much in the beginning you said his logs were large, So how much improvement do you get?
Oh, well, we haven't been able to resend them yet. We could do the collinear logs, but we didn't do. We actually haven't sat down to work out how we've changed it, just because we haven't actually. We didn't actually work it out because we couldn't sum everything. We didn't bother seeing what the effect of it was, and at that stage, it's sort of an. So what is already known is, for example, people have already resummed the logs in KT. So that's what people needed. This was something that was interesting that people were interested in back in sort of the LEP era, because you wanted to look at, say, E plus E minus to jets to get alpha S. And what they discovered was, in order to get a good answer for that, you had to resum all these logs. And then they realized that KT didn't work, that J didn't work. So they put in KT. But still, at that stage, you've only got the leading logs and not the subleading logs. It all depends on what you're interested in. If you're interested in the LHC, you're probably not interested in the same part. You're not interested in these highly collimated jets probably anymore. You've probably got bigger jets, and those logs might not be so important there. So the jets, those particular logs are more important for, say, trying to get alpha from alpha S from the E plus E minus collider to the three jet rate.
So you're saying there's a collinear thing with basically the mechanics. But what if I do a very large force? Would it turn collinear into something?
Yeah, it would. I spent a long time trying to figure it out.
I'm curious.
Yeah, because it's a frame dependent.
This is a dangerous question.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. It's a completely frame dependent. So there's actually a nice, but you can't get rid of the boost entirely, because if you're doing jets, yes, you could always. So the claim would be that you could do this whole calculation in the frame where one of the jets was soft and the other one was collinear. We haven't done that calculation. Actually, Anish Manohar, we did this beautiful paper on deep inelastic scattering in SCT. And he actually did it in two different frames. He did it in like the brick wall frame and whatever the other frame is. So he did in one of the frames, it had two back-to-back collinear guys. So the incoming guy and the outgoing guy were both collinear. In the other frame, the outgoing guy was soft. Just went into its rest frame. And so in SCT, the calculation looks totally different, right? In one, you've got 3 degrees of freedom. In the other, you've got two different collinear directions and soft. The other one, you've only got one collinear direction and soft. But it all worked out exactly the same. So it works. It would be lovely to have a way of showing that as some invariance of the theory. And I'm not aware that anybody's managed to do that. You kind of know it has to work, but it seems a little miraculous that it does work. No, I spent a long time trying to figure out how to make this theory make more sense, that if you could somehow, by exactly what you say, if you could, in the rest frame of a collinear quark, there is no effective theory as far as it's concerned. All the collinears, it's just QCD, right? Because in its rest frame, nothing's happening. The only thing, but then it's QCD in the presence of some Wilson line blasting off in the other direction. So yeah, I spent way too much time trying to see if I could write down the theory in that way, and I actually never managed to succeed. So, but you're right. And you can actually show that in the pure collinear sector of the theory, if you don't couple the soft gluons to it, but in the pure collinear sector of the theory, what the Feynman rules look ghastly. And it turns out all you've done is you've basically written QCD in a very awkward reference frame in a non-Lorentz invariant looking way. But no, you're absolutely right. It's not a Lorentz invariant concept. But things like the Q squared of the event are Lorentz invariants, so you always get something boosted. Okay, wine and cheese.
Wine and cheese sounds good. Thank you, Bruno. Nice talk.